The economy does not look great right now. Things are slowing down. You're seeing layoffs in many, many sectors of the economy. People are slowing down. The probabilities say if we're not in a recession right now, we're likely to be in one very soon.
Jeff Bezos on CNN yesterday. The company he founded, Amazon, plans to lay off 10,000 workers, according to the New York Times, part of a wave of cuts at some of the biggest tech companies. Meta, parent of Facebook and Instagram, laid off more than 11,000 employees, around 13% of its workforce. Twitter has laid off thousands as well, but that's a whole saga into itself with the ballot of Elon Musk, of course. There have been similar layoffs, though, at places like Salesforce, Stripe, Redfin, Lyft, more than 120,000 layoffs so far this year. We're going to talk about this now with Karen Wise. She covers technology for the New York Times. She's based in Seattle. Hi.
Hi there.
So you broke this news that Amazon is expected to lay off around 10,000 employees starting maybe as soon as this week. Amazon declined to comment, but this would be the largest job cut in the company's history. What's behind it?
Yeah, you know, they had this huge pandemic era, like other tech companies, where people just flocked to online services and they overbuilt in many ways. And they've been pulling back on a lot of that actually all year. And what's interesting about this is these are cuts in the corporate ranks. And part of what happened is the pandemic was one of the most profitable period in Amazon's history. And so they could invest heavily in all these different things that they love investing in and innovation and stuff like that. And so on one hand, you had overstaffing on some core stuff, and then also just a lot of spending on other products like devices and Alexa and Echo that they could kind of take losses on for years. And now that the economy is being very uncertain, they have to really look at all of their costs and kind of figure out where to downsize significantly, where to cut, what projects to end entirely, things like that.
But why do they have to do that at all? Because it's an enormously profitable company. They already have something like 1.5 million employees worldwide. So can't they
absorb parts of their company, parts of the company are very profitable. So for example, their cloud computing division and the advertising business. But actually the core, I was actually just speaking with an analyst a moment ago, the rest of their business has actually been losing billions of dollars this year. And Amazon for years operated at very low margins. Parts of their business were very profitable, but they would plow it back into expanding and doing new things. But during the pandemic, investors got really used to having larger profits. And so now there's no way to, they definitely overbuilt. I mean, they've been literally closing warehouses, pulling out of leases, things like that on the fulfillment and operations side of things.
Oh, wow. So the Amazon that we all know, the warehouse that we order our products from, that part is not as profitable as the computing part?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Pretty much all of the profit is driven by the computing part of it, the cloud computing services. It varies in different quarters. There were definitely periods in the pandemic where Amazon's core e-commerce business, like when we buy stuff online and they have third-party sellers and they ship it to us through their drivers and stuff like that, that part of the business can be more profitable the more volume they have. So when they're operating at full capacity, like they were for kind of a good chunk of 2020, 2021, they can actually be really profitable in that business because one van can just go a couple blocks and make a whole bunch of deliveries. And they have these expensive warehouses that they can operate around the clock. But we've seen shopping habits change as the pandemic has receded. So people are spending money elsewhere. We have, they're going to concerts and traveling, traveling's so expensive. And we also have inflation. And so as people pull back a little bit on their consumer spending, they can't be as efficient in the operations. And they also just built assuming kind of a continued increased growth rate that just hasn't panned out.
So as you say, these are cuts in the corporate ranks, but do you expect or do analysts expect more cuts maybe further down, like in the warehouse part
of
it?
They've been contracting in the warehouse all year. They actually cut, I believe it was roughly 80,000 workers total and the overall for the whole company. So basically from warehouse workers over the previous 6 months, but they don't have to do that through layoffs. They have really high turnover. And so when they want to shrink their warehouse workforce. They just kind of let that happen naturally through attrition. Occasionally they might close a building and offer people jobs at other positions nearby, which they may or may not take. But by and large, it's done through attrition.
Okay, moving on to Meta, a parent company of Facebook and Instagram. What's happening there? Why layoffs there?
Yeah, so Meta has a little bit of a different issue. It is in part tied to the broad economy. There's a pullback in advertising spending as companies are worried that, you know, consumers aren't buying as much and we're heading into potentially a recession and all of these things. But Meta also has had problems in that their core product, you know, Facebook and to some degree Instagram is kind of going out of favor with something like TikTok. So like TikTok is kind of the it thing. Advertisers are spending more and more time there. Consumers, young consumers are spending more and more time there. And so they have this kind of bigger picture business model problem. And that's why you see them talking about this pivot to Meta, to the metaverse and the future kind of future technology environments. But that's an expensive change. It's a big change and it's not clear how that will work out. So part of that is part of the Meta layoffs are kind of recognizing both the economic moment, but also that there are problems with their core business.
Wow. So is there a problem with the entire vision of this metaverse that Mark Zuckerberg has promoted?
Well, I think it, from my colleagues who cover it, it sounds like this is a long-term bet and it has not been, you know, manifesting itself yet. I mean, these are very early stages of whatever the metaverse may end up being. And so you can't expect the revenue to come from that already, the kind of sales, and you're in a very heavy investment period trying to figure out what it could be. And is there a consumer demand for it? You know, we don't know yet.
Okay, so other smaller tech companies have also experienced some contractions, as I mentioned in the intro. You live in Seattle, hometown of Amazon and Microsoft, and lots of tech workers. Can you feel it in the city that this is trickling down into other businesses that are maybe seeing problems, like real estate or even the corner cafe?
Yeah, I think, you know, I haven't felt it in that sense. You know, we have seen a downturn in the housing market, as have a lot of places, as interest rates have grown. And you have certainly feel the overall pressures of inflation, but these layoffs are still quite new. So I wouldn't say you feel the ripple effects. I broadly though, there's a lot of, I would say, trepidation or fear, and you have plenty of households where there might be two tech income households. So I've heard of, you know, I'm in like some Facebook groups where people talk about having one partner at Meta and one at Twitter, and just the sheer anxiety over what happens if both get laid off. So that said, broadly, the economy will need tech workers in the long term. It's not like there's not going to be a demand for good product managers or software engineers. I actually heard from the CEO of another tech startup who said, okay, maybe we can actually hire people that we were losing to big tech recently, and maybe the wage pressures won't be as bananas as they were for a startup. So it's not quite clear to me how it'll play out yet.
Okay, we shall see. Karen Wise, Seattle-based tech correspondent for the New York Times. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Church of Scientology has been at the center of two high-profile rape trials. Scientologist and actor Danny Masterson is accused of drugging and raping three women nearly two decades ago. The women were also members of Scientology and say that church officials tried to stop them from going public. Also, Hollywood director Paul Haggis, a former Scientologist and big critic of the Church of Scientology, was found guilty in a civil trial last week for raping a publicist. He says it was consensual, their sex, and he says the allegations against him were fabricated by the church to destroy his reputation. The Church of Scientology is not a party to either case. And joining us now is Noah Goldberg. He's been covering these trials for the Los Angeles Times. Hi.
Hi, Madeline. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, let's begin with Danny Masterson. Closing arguments are happening today. This trial began in October. And at the time when it began, his lawyers wanted the judge to bar any mention of Scientology throughout the trial. Why?
So, yeah, back in October, his lawyer, Philip Cohen, strenuously tried to get the judge in the case Charlene Olmedo to not allow Scientology into the case. Cohen argued at a hearing in October that the actor's proximity to this much maligned religion would be used to paint him as guilty by association. He said that it's disingenuous to say that the government wasn't placing Scientology on trial, even though Scientology wasn't a defendant in the case. And he said that it would make the trial a war on two fronts. He'd be trying to argue that Masterson didn't commit these rapes while also having to, you know, fight this war about Scientology and how much it could be in the trial.
But it has been mentioned in the trial. One of the accusers said that they went to the church for guidance after the after she said she was raped by him, Danny Masterson, and basically said that Scientology told her not to report it, right?
Yeah, Scientology definitely made it into the trial. The judge has limited how much testimony can come in about Scientology, but she says it's key in understanding for the jurors why these women might have delayed reporting the rapes to law enforcement because of their fear of Scientology. And yes, one of the women was brought in by Scientology to talk about the alleged rape, and she had to do weeks of handling, whereas handling is when Scientology makes you, you know, read over L. Ron Hubbard's writings, and it's basically correction for any mistakes that you make in the church, while Masterson himself didn't have to do anything. He was not in any trouble. And some of these women were also told that they, quote, pulled it in, which is a concept in Scientology where anything bad that happens to you is actually your fault because of something you did in the past in your life or in a past life. That brought this negative thing onto you.
Wow. Okay, so then there's the trial for Paul Haggis, the director. He was found guilty, and this is a civil trial, and ordered to pay around $10 million in damages and for raping a publicist. And Scientology was also brought up in this trial. How was that brought up?
Yeah, it's really interesting because it's kind of the opposite of what was going on in the Masterson trial. In the Masterson trial, you have prosecutors and alleged victims saying that Scientology tried to cover up a rape or multiple rapes, whereas in the Paul Haggis trial, you have an ex-Scientologist claiming that the church is making up a rape against him and collaborating with this woman to destroy his career by bringing up these rape allegations. So it's really totally on the other side. But an issue there is that Haggis didn't really have any proof that could tie the Church of Scientology to the woman who was accusing him of sexual assault. So he kind of brought in all this stuff about how he was this vocal critic of the church, and that's why they wanted to destroy him, destroy his career. But he and his lawyers, frankly, stipulated to the fact that they couldn't tie the woman to Scientology. So they just hoped to sow the seed in jurors' minds that, you know, potentially there was this nefarious conspiracy between Scientology and the woman. But obviously, at the end of the day, the jurors didn't buy it because they found him liable for the sexual assault and are forcing him to pay millions of dollars.
Right. And he had some high profile witnesses in his defense, a former Scientologist named Mike Rinder, who has spoken a lot about what goes on behind closed doors there. And also Leah Remini, the actress.
Yes, of course. Those are two of the most vocal critics of the church. Mike Rinder used to be the chief spokesperson for the church for many years. But they've all subsequently left, and they're kind of part of this cohort of former Scientologists who critique the church a lot. And Remini and Rinder both got on the stand, and though they don't know whether or not there's a conspiracy, they both testified about the church's fair game tactics in which it attacks critics. And Rinder even told me in an interview that he believes the church is behind the allegations against Haggis. But again, there was no evidence exactly proving that.
Right. And okay. And that trial is over. He was found guilty. The women in the Masterson trial, getting back to that, have also sued the church in a separate lawsuit. So what are they claiming there?
Yeah. In the separate lawsuit, the women who have accused Masterson of rape claim that the church came after them starting in 2016 after they went to law enforcement. And they say that the church has been harassing and stalking them ever since. One woman even claimed that she believed the church officials poisoned her dog. They've reported things like people peering into their homes late at night, repeatedly coming out in the morning to their cars, having all their doors and trunk open. The Church of Scientology obviously denies that they're stalking or harassing the women, and they say they're actually the ones being harassed by these women. And in that civil trial, actually, you will expect to hear a lot more about the church and its fair game tactics, because that'll be the first trial in which the church is actually a defendant in the case, as opposed to just, you know, an ancillary character.
All right. Noah Goldberg, reporter for the LA Times, covering the Danny Masterson trial. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, the future of gas stations is murky as we move to an EV future. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, the United States is moving toward an electric car future. California is banning the sale of new gas-powered cars beginning in 2035. And President Biden has pledged to make half of the new vehicles sold nationwide zero emissions by 2030. So, with all these new electric vehicles, how to charge them? Some gas stations are preparing now by building charging ports, but with our maze-like electricity infrastructure with competing utilities in each state, it is not an easy transition. David Ferris has been exploring what the future might hold for gas stations in a big piece for Politico's E&E News. Welcome back to Press Play, David.
Thanks for having me, Madeline.
Great to have you back. Well, you begin your story with the example of this chain Come and Go, and anyone who's driven across the country has probably seen one of these 400 stations in around 11 states. And you look at one outside Denver that really epitomizes the problems that these gas stations are facing with this transition to EVs. What's happening at that particular gas station?
Come and Go, this chain of gas stations, very intentionally put its charging station in that location and not in other surrounding locations, because there's one particular fee that gas station is required to pay to the electricity company that is far lower in that spot than it would be in other utility areas. And that gets to a big continuous problem that gas stations are going to have with electric vehicles.
Well, explain how that works. The electric company charges the gas station for the electricity that would come through the charging port for the car?
They're electricity customers, so they get charged like anyone. And that reflects on their bill as something called a demand charge. And if a gas station or if a charging station is in the position of having a lot of EVs charge all at the same time, it can suddenly vault that gas station into the league of a factory, for example, in the amount of power it's using. But because it doesn't have any control over when those drivers are going to come and can't manage its power use, it can end up paying far more in electricity bills than it can ever hope to charge you for charging your electric car. And so that gets to a big disconnect between the way that the electric utilities manage electricity and the way the gas stations typically work.
So, for example, if there were, let's say, I don't know, half a dozen cars charging at once, how much would that cost the gas station?
Well, the interesting thing is it really depends a lot. I mean, at this station in Wellington, it would cost six times less than if the station was located a few blocks to the north. So the way I think about it is that when you're driving around, in this case it was Denver, but really it's true anywhere in the country, you're skating around on this invisible map of utility service territories. You know, no one really knows when you're traveling around what service territory you're in. But it is a matter of financial life and death for a gas station that wants to put in EV chargers. It makes it, it's going to make the difference between whether that station loses money or possibly makes money.
Wow. Okay. So these gas stations are trying to figure out, well, look, this electric train is coming, so to speak. We need to adjust because there'll just be fewer cars that need gas and more that need electricity. So how are they trying to get around this, this uneven price structure from the utilities?
In the case of Come and Go, they kind of got on the train early and found the locations where it made the most financial sense for them to put in chargers. And since Come and Go has jumped in, a lot of other gas station chains are following suit.
Where does the new infrastructure bill come in? Because that has $7.5 billion for EV charging stations. So couldn't that equalize the playing field, if you will, by having the federal government step in and pay for this?
It does. In most of the country, the amount that the federal government is going to pay is going to make it financially worthwhile enough to operate a charging station. And so gas stations are going to start embracing these, not because they see it as a wonderful opportunity, but because they don't really have much of a choice.
And do electric utilities have to give up something? Would they have to maybe lower their prices for this demand charge so that this can work?
Yeah, for example, in your area, for example, Southern California Edison has come up with something called a demand charge holiday, where they are holding off on those charges for a number of years for those who want to host these charging stations, including gas stations. And so a lot that provides a little bit of comfort, but not a ton to gas stations, because the unique problem with offering charging to electric cars and their drivers is that we all know that most of that charging is actually going to happen at home or at the workplace. Mm-hmm. And it's not clear that we're going to need very many, I don't know what you call them, former gas stations or stations that offer both kinds of fuel. It's not really clear that how much people are going to stop on the road in order to fuel.
Right. And even if they do, they could just stop at a Walmart and not even go to a gas station.
Yeah. And that's one of the really interesting things is that you're starting to see that other businesses are waking up to an opportunity to take business away from the gas station. And the reason for that is that we're talking here about the what are called fast chargers that can fill your car in 15 to 40 minutes, let's say. And another problem that gas stations have is that they're not exactly cozy places to hang out for 15 to 40 minutes. There's not even
quite the opposite,
right? But there are a lot of places where your stop is that length of time. Starbucks, Walgreens, the grocery store. All of those are businesses that are starting to offer that fast charging because they realize they might be in a better position to offer it than gas stations.
So are we really looking at the twilight of the gas station? I mean, it's a little sad when you think of the history of it as really tied to the history of the United States, definitely in the West. But I mean, progress is progress.
It is. One thing I've done a lot in this story is ponder the troubled story of the gas station. And it really has been our partner for a century here. While we've gone on the roads, there are these unloved, neglected places that people sort of endure spending a little bit of their time. But they're not places that are celebrated as an American institution. And one thing that will, I think, start to become apparent is that, gas stations have these signs for like major fuelers like, Shell and BP and Chevron on the sign. But in fact, a lot of them, most of them are small business owners that own just one or a few stations. And those small owners are the ones who are least financially prepared to make the jump to servicing electric vehicles. And so as gas stations close, it's probably actually going to be those small local entrepreneurs who are going to suffer most.
So as they're facing this uncertain future, aside from putting in electric charging stations, they would also have to, as you say, retool to make them nicer places. So that's also a huge expense. Are they willing to bear that to make the gas station a place where you'd actually want to hang out?
Well, come and go. They're offering Wi-Fi. They're offering tables and chairs, sometimes outdoor seating, a beer cave, a kitchen that makes...
A beer cave?
A beer cave. I don't quite know how that jives with the whole driving thing. But beer caves and also, kitchen that makes protein bowls and fresh pizzas and that kind of thing in order to make the gas station, to refashion it as a place you actually want to be.
All right. Well, I guess good luck to them in that in that endeavor. I don't know. I think when you're on the road, you want to be on the road and go somewhere else.
Yeah. Well, I mean, inevitably, we're going to be spending more time in our EVs fueling on the road. Mm-hmm. And so someone's going to offer that service. And during that time, you're going to be doing something. We don't know yet where it's going to be or what you're going to be doing.
I'm going to be doing my Wordle. So
I'll be
on the phone in the car doing my Wordle. David Ferris, reporter for Politico's E&E News, where he covers the intersection of transportation and the electric grid. And check out his big piece on the future of gas stations. David, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me. I enjoyed it.
Coming up, celebrity magician Penn Jillette is here. In a wide-ranging interview, we talk magic, his new book, and his political shift away from strict libertarianism.
During the lockdown, libertarianism looked to me like rich white guys do whatever the hell they wanted, and that nauseated me.
Penn Jillette is here next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Penn Jillette is the tall, boisterous member of the magician duo Penn and Teller. He's the one who talks. The popularity of their Las Vegas magic show helped launch several TV shows. The new season of Penn and Teller Fool Us just premiered this month on the CW network. Well, when Penn's not doing magic, he is writing. His new novel, Random, tells the story of a son who inherits his father's crippling gambling debt just before his 21st birthday. And if the debt is not paid back, he, along with his mother and sister, will likely be murdered. A random roll of the dice at a casino solves his money problems. Now rich, he decides to make all his life decisions based on the roll of the dice. Thus, the title Random. Joining us is actor, magician, writer, musician, Penn Jillette. Hi, Penn.
How are you doing?
I am well. You're a multi-hyphenate. So tell us about this novel and how did you come up with this idea?
Well, I came up with the idea because I met someone. I had a woman I was working with and she rolled the dice and she said it felt religious. She instantly acted on it. And she began living her life like this. And I said, wow, are you still doing that? And she opened her briefcase, because this was back 30 years ago, and it wasn't all backpacks. And she had these two really ornate dice. And she said, yeah. And I said, wait a minute. We wanted you to work on our show, but everybody told us you were out of our league. And the producers were really surprised when you said yes. And she said, yeah, I rolled an eight. And I said, so you're doing this show? She said, yeah. And I said, you make decisions artistically on our show, are you doing those at random? And she said, only when I'm not sure what to do, only when there's doubt.
Huh. So let me get more into this dice life idea, because it really fascinates me what you said, that people actually do this. Because I always think, well, you should roll the dice and then you can decide what you really want, because you can say, oh, I don't like that. I don't want to do that.
And then there's that whole philosophy that if you want to decide on something, flip a coin, and while the coin is in the air, decide what you're hoping.
Right. And then you'll really know what you want.
Very different from that. This is laying it out and just saying, when that hits, God has declared that that's what I do, and acting on it immediately with never changing your mind.
Wow, that is quite a commitment. And you don't do it for every single decision.
No, of course not. If you're sure what you want to do, if it's clear to you, then there's no reason to roll the dice. And you also, I will say, you never put anything on the list that a part of you doesn't strongly want to do. You never put something on the list that you find immoral or wrong or that you don't desire. But you put the things on the list that maybe every time before have lost in that, you know, that voting in your head, that the society of mind has voted against it. You decide to give it a chance, and not a big chance, but maybe 4%.
Have you ever done it?
I'm terrified of doing it. Terrified, because I do everything in excess. I do not believe in moderation. And one of the reasons I've never had a drink of alcohol or any drug, I'm terrified of this. And I have a family, and I also have, you know, a few dozen people that work with Penn & Teller that I'm responsible to. And I'd be really afraid that I would sincerely want something like 2% and roll the dice and get that and hurt other people. So I go to a great deal of trouble to make the protagonist in this book completely moral, but young enough and with few enough responsibilities that he can do this dice thing without hurting other people. And although he's very sexually and socially on the fringe, everything he does is at least within my morality.
Right. And so he could kind of live your fantasy without you having to live it yourself.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
So you get to live this life and not really live it. I guess you're sort of describing yourself as risk averse.
Well, I am not risk averse in anything that does not have permanent consequences. Like, I don't mind losing money. I don't mind bombing. I don't mind failing. But I get very upset when some of our peers in magic do things that are actually dangerous, mm-hmm. because I believe that what you've done is you've made the audience complicit in a disregard of human life and safety. And I don't want to do that. People came to see us, you know, on Broadway or in Vegas, and we put Teller in a tank of water and he drowns. We are asking the audience to laugh at that. And I believe the only way they can laugh at that is to know, wait a minute, these guys have been going 40 years. They never get hurt. Let's laugh our asses off.
Right. And so I guess that there are very famous magicians like Chris Angel who have done stuff that have been very dangerous.
Or here's the thing. I mean, it's not my job to betray his secrets. Some of the things aren't dangerous and just appear it. Mm-hmm. But I do believe within my morality, which is very specific on this, I don't share it with a lot of magicians. I believe that you as an audience member have to believe it's safe. We did a thing called the bullet catch, which is the most dangerous trick in magic. 12 magicians have died doing it on stage. And we came up with a safe way to do it with many levels of safety. And we were very, very proud of it. But everybody, all the PR people, even fans, told us, you must say that people have died doing this and every night you could die. And I said, if we say that, I no longer like our audience. If you would come to see that, you are not the kind of person I respect, and I don't want to perform for people I don't respect. So I would say, which I think is very unusual for a magician, we're going to do something that looks really, really dangerous, and I promise you it's 100% safe. And there's no chance of us getting hurt. Because if I were in an audience, that's what I want. And once you've told me that, then you get as gory and as dangerous as possible. But let me know that morally I'm okay.
That's really interesting, because I think you're right that the audience needs a net.
Or the audience that I like needs a net. You know what I mean? There are a lot of people, I believe, or I've been told, who go to NASCAR in order to see a crash. There are people that are like that. I just don't want to be around them. That's all.
Yeah, I get it. Well, it's interesting that you have such a strong sense of morality and you are an atheist. And a lot of people who are God-fearing would say you cannot have this strong sense of morality without some kind of religion.
I would argue, and this is a rather facile argument, I would contend that you cannot have morality if you do believe in God, because morality is the choice of doing right and wrong because of what you think is right and wrong. If you believe in God, especially a Judeo-Christian God who is reward and punishment, if you believe in that, then you are doing things to avoid punishment and to receive reward. And if you've ever raised children, you know that that is not morality. Mm. That is not morality at all. That is coercion. But I've been asked, if you don't believe in God, why don't you just rape and murder anybody you want to? And my answer is, I have. I have raped and murdered everybody I want to, which is nobody. How many people do you want to rape and murder? Because I've done it, and it's nobody. I don't even want to hurt anybody.
Well, I want to maybe roll over into another related question, and that is a question about your political beliefs. Famously, you are or were a libertarian?
Yeah, it got very complicated. There was a rather heartbreaking moment for me. I got an email before the vaccine that said that there was going to be an anti-mask rally in Vegas. And of course, I was expected to lead it. And I read those words and said, the fact that anyone sees me that way scares me to death, because I can make the argument. I'm not sure I believe it, but I'll make the argument to you that maybe wearing seatbelts should not be mandated. I cannot make the argument for driving drunk. So I might be able to make the argument, and by the way, I'm not going to, that masks don't need to be government mandated. But I would never make the argument that you shouldn't wear them, because you do not have the right, morally and I think legally, to get other people sick. During the pandemic, please forgive me for even forming the sentence this way, there was something a little bit beautiful or a little bit touching about how quickly the virus spread around the world and how connected we are. And I know that's a horrible, horrible thing. I used to have a stronger feeling about individuals making the decision to work collectively without having to pull people in line with force. And my definition of libertarian, which is my personal definition, was to ask on every question, is there a way to solve this problem with more freedom instead of less? And sometimes the answer is no. But during the virus, I realized that when you get a kind of tribalism going on, and when you have a clearly insane person like Trump in control, and you have people going QAnon crazy, it's possible that I'm a little less of an optimist than I used to be about people making an individual choice that is best for the people around them. I mean, libertarianism, I always believed, contained more responsibility. And when other people would say libertarianism is just rich white guys want to do whatever the hell they want, I would say, no, it's all about responsibility. During the lockdown, libertarianism looked to me like rich white guys do whatever the hell they wanted. And that nauseated me.
Right. So I guess that goes with what you said earlier, that you would have to believe or trust that people would develop strong morality on their own without being told what to do.
I think it was Steve Allen, maybe, who said, my right to wave my arms stops at your face. Your right to not wear a mask stops, with people's grandparents dying. I don't want to oversimplify it, but I guess tribalism made people anti-vaccine. You know, the most astounding accomplishment in human history, dwarfs landing on the moon, and then you had a bunch of gazoonies who were saying, oh, no, we're not going to do it. After I screamed myself hoarse over that, I thought I have to change the way I'm labeled a little bit. Hmm.
So you don't call yourself a libertarian?
Well, I don't really, because I still am pathologically optimistic, and both libertarianism and atheism come out of being optimistic. And even with what we've gone through with January 6th and so on, somehow I still believe that out of the 7.6 billion people on the planet, just about 7.6 billion are good. I don't believe there's such a thing as evil. I believe that people are wrong, but they're not evil. But It's been a tough 4 or 5 years.
Yeah. And you're someone who has worked directly with Donald Trump on Celebrity Apprentice.
I know him well, yeah.
So you do know him well. And so what you saw in the Oval, when he was in the Oval Office, and what you're seeing now as he is denying the election, is that the man that you worked with?
I told everybody, and I mean everybody, no matter how bad you think he is, he's worse. I thought back to a conversation I had with Donald Trump Jr., who said to me, "You know, Penn, I think you're the only person that seems to like my father." Wow. He said, "Why is that?" And I said, "Well, I have incredible tolerance for eccentricity." And when I was on Celebrity Apprentice, I was fascinated, you know, that Donald Trump, when he would speak to us rambling, pontificating nonsense, this guy has no filters. He has no shame whatsoever. He has no compassion. He has no empathy. So listening to him talk tells me something about the flaws. And I was fascinated. So I listened to him forever. It's a monkey paw situation, right? It's like, oh, there's this guy you're kind of interested in. Oh, by the way, he's going to be president. Ah! Two things that blew my mind about Donald Trump on a lighter level, because the actual nightmare stuff we're all well versed in. Never saw him enjoy music. Never saw him tap his foot to music. Huh. Now, he does that kind of grotesque wiggling at his rallies, kind of like he's copying people who know music. But I have been, when a band was playing next to him and looked down and neither foot is moving. And I've never seen that. Also, I never saw him laugh at a joke or make a joke. Now, before you disagree, let me define joke. Joke does not mean, ha ha, you're getting old and ugly, baby. Mm-hmm. That's not a joke. You're kind of fat. He would laugh at that kind of stuff, deriding other people uproariously. But I never heard a turn of phrase or an actual pleasant heartfelt joke caused him to laugh. And I've never seen that in anybody. And I, you know, I've been in jail.
Well, what does that tell you?
It tells me, I think, that there is a social disconnect. Laughing and being able to tap your foot to music is a way to connect. And he does not connect. I mean, I did not see him exhibit what I consider to be friendship ever. And, you know, I was fascinated that someone's going through life that way. There are wonderful people who have all sorts of eccentricities. And I kind of grooved with Celebrity Apprentice. I kind of went along with it. And I even, although no one else has ever said this, was on the show, I kind of sort of enjoyed it. And I loved hearing him talk forever because it was so insane. And because it was so different from the way I felt. And this idea, if I told you right now, I promise you, every one of your dreams will come true. All you have to do is never say I'm sorry or admit you're wrong. You could not do it for 24 hours. It would break your heart. You would not feel human. And yet he's been doing it his whole life.
And yet you have some empathy for him.
Oh, yes. I think he's able to suffer. You know, some of the things that make him suffer, I find repulsive. You know, he can suffer from not being the strongest in the room in his own mind. But I do believe there's actual suffering there. Just no perception. I think he could watch somebody get their leg run over and not recoil.
Wow.
I'm not reporting. I'm speculating.
Right.
I'm not telling you anything you didn't know.
No.
I think you probably noticed that Donald Trump as president was a bit odd.
It was a little off. It was a little off, for sure. For sure.
You probably noticed that, yeah.
So how involved are you in politics or observing what's happening in in the political sphere. Is that something that you are concerned with?
I've never had an interest in being active in it. And I'm afraid that I enjoyed having odd opinions on politics when I felt the grownups were in charge. Like, I really enjoyed having ideas that were contrary to Obama, because in my heart, I knew that Obama was a good person who was doing what he thought was best, and disagreeing with him felt like our political process in action. And I really loved it and felt safe and felt all democratic. I don't want to get into this whole thing, but I was talking to Al Franken right after Donald Trump was elected. And Al Franken is someone I fought about politics with since we were both on Saturday Night Live. And Trump was elected, and I ran into Al. And I said, Al, as of that election, you and I agree on everything. And he said, that's correct.
So I guess I'm wondering, as you are thinking about where we are as a country and how your political beliefs are changing and evolving, considering how you're looking at things differently through the lens of the pandemic and through your knowledge of Donald Trump, how are you sensing where we are right now and what the next few years holds in store for us as a country, as a culture?
Well, I'm crying a lot. I'm very worried. Whenever you start losing faith in people, the cure for that is to be around people. And, you know, there's nobody on the streets of Manhattan that won't help you if you have real trouble. It really happens. But we have gotten this idea of evil deep into people's minds. And it doesn't matter what side you're on. It's the fact that if you believe there's a side that's evil, and when you get this thing in your head that the end justifies the means, which I believe is one of the most dangerous ideas that people have ever thought of, because there are no ends, there are only means. That's what life is. I think that Republicans, mostly, that's just true, and I believe provable, have decided that there is an evil, and that whatever they need to do to shut down that evil is worth it. Therefore, they're putting people in positions where they can negate election results. That's being done by good people who think they are fighting evil and who are deeply, deeply wrong. And because of being wrong and because of thinking they're fighting evil and because of being led by some people who actually may have no empathy and no concern, they may bring an end to democracy as we know it. Now, that sentence, if you told me 6 years ago, 7 years ago, that I would have said it, I would have said there is nothing that can happen in the world that I could say that sentence. But now I think there is a non-zero, very low, but non-zero chance that we will actually put a form of fascism into place in the United States. And I don't know what happens then. I just don't know.
Can we end on an up note?
Yeah. You know, we do this show called Better Tell or Fool Us. It's been on 11 seasons. And it could not be more jovial. You know, one of the things that I disliked about the talent shows that were on TV is that the judges would be mean. You know, they would make jokes at the performer's expense. Our show is not a competition. You get into magic because you love to be fooled. Keller and I love being fooled, and you keep chasing, as I say, that first high, and it gets harder and harder as you learn more. Producers go around the world and they find these fabulous magicians who come on. We don't judge them on their performance or how much we like them. We always like them. They're always really good. We just have this one very almost objective criterion, which is, did you fool us? And the proof of the happiness of this show is after someone fools us, everybody during the commercial runs down and tells us how it's done. No, no, no. Here's what you missed. Here's the good thing about it. It just has this feeling of camaraderie. You know, every other magic show on TV, essentially the crew and the director are in cahoots with the magician. Mm-hmm. But on our show, you really are seeing exactly what was seen in the theater. We've seen over 350, I think, now, and about 12% have fooled us. And every time it's full of joy. The fact that somebody can spend an amount of time that you can't imagine working on one little stupid thing that for a moment switches your reality is just so beautiful. It makes me cry. It's just a great thing. Fool Us does have that, and it does have kindness. And you can go through all of that as I sit in Donald Trump's position, and you won't hear me say one mean thing to anyone, because why would you bother doing that? You need more happiness.
Yeah. Well, Penn Jillette, it's been such a pleasure talking with you. Thanks for coming on the show today.
So nice talking with you.
Penn Jillette, his book Random is in bookstores. It's also online. And his show, Penn and Teller Fool Us, airs on the CW Fridays at 8 o'clock. And that's it for us on Press Play today. Have a great day. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.